Welcome back, Michael Warren Thomas. Sir, it's naturally green and naturally white this morning. SaverLife.com is how you can find me. Michael@SaverLife.com is my email. And winter finally arrived, really. It's been a mild so-called winter up till now, but this week looks not unreasonably cold, just normal temperatures, I think, basically, and some nice snow to decorate everything. So if I saw a couple posts from people who cut their forsythia and brought it inside a couple of weeks ago, and it's starting to flower. So obviously it would have been a little easier to cut it last weekend than this weekend, but you can still really go out anytime, cut some forsythia and bring it indoors. As I said last weekend, cut branches that have more buds on them and not the straight suckers, and you'll have just more colorful branches when you force them into bloom. So don't cut them all today or tomorrow. I would cut some today and some a few days from now, and you'll have forsythia blooming for months inside. But by the time it blooms outside, you don't even care. You'll have seen it for months indoors, and it blooms quite a while. These bright yellow flowers really is kind of nice to have that. And if you don't have any in your yard, maybe a friend or neighbor does, check in with them and see if you can cut a few branches periodically and maybe force them into bloom for them. And yeah, once they're starting to bloom, you can leave it by their front door or something, and they can enjoy the forsythia. So a couple of weeks, one of the people that posted said it was about 2 weeks. As we get closer to spring, it'll bloom faster than that. It might take 3 weeks at this point, but give it a try, and then experiment with some other ones. You don't need to have, 15 branches of every single plant in your yard, but one or two of several spring flowering plants, and just see what happens. You want to cut the stem while it's held underwater, and with Valentine's Day coming up, roses are going to be in great supply. In spite of the pandemic, there will be lots of roses available. And roses are one of the plants that you really need to do this same procedure on, cutting the stem while it's underwater. And you don't need to keep it underwater after that. It's more the initial cut, and then you can transfer it to a vase. So I put a little bowl or glass or something in my sink, and I hold the stem just underwater and make a cut on an angle. That gives a bigger opening to the openings that move water through the stem. It'll work more easily when you cut them in the when they're you just have them out in the air and cut them. It sucks in air, an air bubble, and that's one of the reasons that roses will collapse and just nod off fairly quickly, because water is not moving in the stem. There's an air bubble that's slowing it down or stopping it. So when you put it underwater and cut it, it sucks up water. And it's like a capillary action. So once it's sucked up that little bit of water, then you can take it out and move it to another, to your more permanent vase, however you want to display your flowers, your roses, or these stems that you're cutting to force things into bloom. And one of the reasons it's important to do that with the stems that you're trying to force into bloom is that they're going to be in water for a few weeks. It's going to take maybe 4 to 5 weeks for some of the things to bloom. Forsythia will bloom sooner, but other things might take longer, like lilacs or apple blossoms. So you want as big an opening as possible, so you cut it on a 45-degree angle, and there are some people that promote smashing the stems, and I've never been a big fan of this. It's kind of awkward to do. I've tried it. You know, you can't really do it very easily on the counter because you don't really want to use a hammer to smash stems on the counter in your kitchen. You know, so I would do it on the sidewalk or take it down in the basement on the concrete floor. But it's kind of messy. It makes the water, you know, kind of dirty looking just from the little pieces of the stems that come off. It may work to help water move through the plant, but the cut stems on a 45 degree angle are just cleaner, better looking, and so that's the way I do it. Really important to do with roses. If you have a bouquet of other flowers as well, doesn't hurt to do the same thing to those. It's just that roses are more finicky than many other flowers. And it may have something to do with the stems too. Rose stems are maybe woodier. It may have to do with structure of the stem beyond, you know, just the roses being finicky. So cut them on an angle, the roses, as well as things that you're going to bring inside to bloom. I think I mentioned a couple weeks ago that I found some wild cucumber seed pods in Ellison Park. And if you want to go see them, it was climbing up through a shrub. So I'm sure there's plenty of these seed pods left. They don't have any seeds in them, though. They dropped the seeds. They have kind of like the bottom opens up on these seed pods, and you know the seeds just drop out. Nothing too spectacular, but it looks kind of odd when you get hold of one of these seed pods and you look at the bottom of it, and there's just these sort of gaping holes where the seeds came out. But the pods themselves look like spiny blowfish. I mean, they're worth going over to see. It's the easternmost part of Ellison Park along Blossom Road. On the north side of the road, there's a couple shelters there and a little parking lot in that corner of Ellison Park. Again, not far from the road. But you drive into the park over the stream, which is Arundhequit Creek, I think, and then turn right, go to the parking lot for one of the shelters, and then walk down the road that's blocked off to traffic. People are welcome to walk. They just blocked it off to traffic that heads back toward Blossom Road. And this shrub is really just before you get to Blossom Road. And this little lightly colored vine is growing through the shrub with these, again, like little pufferfish, spiny blowfish. They're bizarre looking things. And supposedly it's a native plant. They're not edible. I think from what I've read, if you cut it open thinking you're going to have a cucumber, there's not really the same kind of flesh inside that you want to eat. So I don't think you'll eat it by mistake. But the outside is very spiny. It reminded me of a cucumber. So that's when I saw it, that's what I was thinking about. But generally cucumbers, you know, if you found some in your garden that have, you know, rotted in your garden at the end of the summer, or some point during the summer, they just turn into mush and completely disappear, basically. And these wild cucumbers retain their shape and have these moderately long spines all over them. But you can kind of, you know, think back to to cucumbers, they have little tiny spines, some of them. These are just much longer and sharper. But again, kind of fun to see. And so you won't find any seeds to collect and bring home, but you'll know where to look for these next year because the seeds just dropped right down around the shrub, and there'll probably be a bunch of them growing here. So it is a native plant. It is supposedly kind of invasive, although it's not considered an invasive plant. It can be kind of a pest, but probably pretty easy to pull out. You know, it's something in the cucumber family. It's an annual, so it doesn't set up roots that are going to come back every year. So it's probably not too much of a pest. I've never seen them for sale at a garden center. The flowers are probably not very interesting, I would guess. But I'm going to go back to this part of Ellison Park this summer and watch some of these others grow, assuming they do, and see what they look like. Again, a wild cucumber. You can look it up online, see what it's like, and let me know if you go over to Ellison Park to check it out. There also are beaver working in Ellison Park, ironically very close to the dog park. The beaver are smart enough to realize, I guess, that the dogs are fenced in and generally otherwise on a leash, so they are, for some reason, working literally right next to the dog park fence. I mean, it's kind of funny. I've never found the lodge. There may or may not be one. I assume there's one around because it looks like they're working here during the winter. I did look some more in Genesee Valley Park for evidence of beaver because there is a lodge that I found just off the Genesee Riverway Trail, which is just south of 390, the west side of the river. And when I was walking down that side, I saw the trees that have been gnawed by the beaver, lots of them, a couple dozen trees probably, that are in various stages of being gnawed by the beaver. And the lodge is right along the water side. And I was thinking, you know, they're working on enough trees on this side of the river that maybe they are thinking they can dam the river. I don't know. That seems like a very unlikely proposition. But I have to learn more about beaver. These are maybe very optimistic, unrealistic beaver. Who knows? But then from the bike trail, you don't need to go off the bike trail to see the evidence of the beaver. It's right from the bike trail, which makes, you know, it's paved. It's really an easy walk. You park in by the tennis courts of Genesee Valley Park, maybe, and then walk along the Riverway Trail. Pretty bridges. It's some gorgeous views of the canal and the river from that area. And a lot of people, I don't think, go over there. I seldom see people when I'm over there. And I haven't seen the beaver actually themselves. I just see the evidence of them and their lodge. But I think they are active some during the winter. If you know, it's not frozen over, and the Genesee River doesn't often freeze over, so they can get around pretty easily right now. But from the west side of the river, that trail, looking across, it looked like there are quite a few trees down on the other side of the river, and so I was wondering if the beaver were working over there. I couldn't really see that far across exactly what was going on. So I went over to the golf course, which is there along the river, and you can kind of take a walk through the golf course, stay off the greens and the finely mowed areas as much as possible, because they are just harder to maintain, and you don't want to damage them. There was someone out there golfing last Sunday. I think it was last Sunday. They were well bundled up. It wasn't a warm day. It wasn't as cold as right now, but they were out there golfing. I don't think the golf course was open. I'm sure it wasn't open, of course, But they were hitting a few golf balls from the tee, from one of the tees. So went over to the riverside of the golf course, and there's evidence of beaver chewing on a lot of trees. Now, after and seeing that, I'm thinking maybe they really are trying to dam the river. I mean, they're between the two sides of the river. It must be about 100 trees, literally 100 trees that they have gnawed on to some degree. A whole lot of them are not gnawed that much. They're not going to fall over imminently. They're alive, but they clearly have marks on them. And so you wonder what the beaver's up to. I mean, it's clear that some of the ones on the west side of the river, they gnawed about halfway through. And then these are trees that are tend to be leaning over the river anyway for light. And so the beaver seem to be calculating that they can, you know, gnaw half of it, and Mother Nature will take care of the rest with some wind and snow, and the tree will break on its own. But on the other side of the river, I didn't, it was kind of muddy, so I didn't go in and really look closely at the trees, but there seemed to be, you know, a small amount of gnawing on many of the trees that will potentially eventually cause the tree to fall as the trunk, as that wood rots, exposed, not protected by the bark. So, you know, it's kind of like these beaver are thinking, you know, 10 years down the road, these trees are going to go in the water. So it is kind of fascinating. You know, even 100 trees are not going to dam the river, but, you know, at some point, I don't know, maybe 100 trees would dam the river. It's kind of fascinating to watch. It'll be fun to see how far along the river they work, and how they perhaps expand in numbers to other parts of the canal, the creeks and streams that go into the river and into the canal. So it's been fun to see, and don't have to go far to see them. It's literally like a 5-minute walk from the tennis courts in Genesee Valley Park down the west side of the river, the Riverway Trail. So let me know if you run into things like this. If you're interested in birding, the Birdhouse has programs they do online on Saturday mornings, usually at 10 o'clock. Also Tuesday mornings, they have online programs, and Liz Magnotti, their general manager, does an awesome job with those. So bring some binoculars when you're out. If you don't have any binoculars, Birdhouse sells them. And if you're out looking for the beaver or whatever, I've got to bring my binoculars next time so that when I'm on the east side of the river checking out those trees, I can use the binoculars to see if the beaver's over on the around the lodge. Without binoculars, it's hard to see very easily that far. I did see a kayaker out there last week also. That seemed a bit chilly to be out on the river, and I didn't see anyone with them. If you do decide to go out kayaking or anything like that, you want to go with, you want to have two people along, or you know, someone who's, if they're not in the water, is nearby, because the water is dangerous. This, you know, any time of the year can be, but especially during the winter. So as far as I could tell, maybe there was another kayaker somewhere that I couldn't see from my vantage point. But, you know, people are anxious to get outside during the winter. So because of the pandemic, we are perhaps doing things we wouldn't normally do, trying to get outside, and just be careful, especially with the water and you know, canoes and kayaks and things this time of the year. You can reach me with comments, questions, michael@saverlife.com. One of our listeners dropped off a catalog for me. It's Pine Tree Garden Seeds and Accessories. And you can find them online, superseeds.com. Superseeds.com. And a really cool seed catalog. It's got a lot of unusual varieties, some nice descriptions of them. There are small photos, and I've got a big selection. I don't see any wild cucumbers in here, but they do have the edible cucumbers and many, many different kinds, probably 20 different varieties or more of cucumbers. And again, you find them online. It's superseeds.com. Another seed catalog to check out, rareseeds.com, which is Baker Creek Heirloom Seed Company. And they have some amazing seeds. Fruition Seeds, which is one of the local seed companies, along with Crossman Seed Company, East Rochester. Fruition Seeds is in Naples. Does not have retail except in the spring. I'm not sure what they'll do this year with the pandemic, but they certainly sell mail order. And it's not too early to think about seeds. I mean, February is like a week away. And that's a very hopeful thing to read about seeds and think about what you want to grow this year. And looking forward to getting the seeds shipped to you and maybe starting a few of them early. There's always been something special about getting a packet of seeds or several packets of seeds in the mail during the winter. So maybe it's flowers or herbs. Maybe it's perennials you want to grow from seed. Maybe it's all kinds of vegetables and fruit. There are lots of cool options. And the catalogs like this sometimes have some the cutting-edge accessories. Also, I got a White Flower Farm catalog, and these used to be more important a few decades ago because that was how you found some of the newest, most interesting varieties of plants. But, you know, for the last, you know, like 30 years, we've had places like Sarah's Garden Center and Palmiter's Nursery and Grandpa's Nursery and Bristol's and Wayside, and those are what I call the destination nurseries, and their selections are just amazing, and you're buying local. So you know, the White Flower Farm catalog is fun to look at, to see what might be coming, what to look for at local nurseries, but I would much rather buy the plants themselves than basically the roots that you're buying through White Flower Farm. So what you get is not very impressive. That's not White Flower Farm's fault. It's the way things are shipped, and you don't get to choose which plants you want. They send you, you know, whatever they have available of that variety of plant. I would rather go to a nursery and choose the pot, specific pot of that variety that I want to purchase and plant. So again, use some of those catalogs for ideas, but for plants, perennials, shrubs, trees, you know, I think it makes a lot more sense to buy local, not just for supporting local, but also because you get to choose the ones that you want. And when you see them in person versus the photos, you might change your mind on which variety you want and decide you want one with different foliage or slightly different color flower, or maybe you just don't really like it at all when you see it in person. And some of the places like Sarah's and Palmiter's have gardens that you can see some of these plants in and see what they grow like, what they grow into. So, again, think about buying local and also just about selection. I didn't count the number of perennials in the White Flower Farms catalog, but I'm guessing that places like Palmiter's and Sarah's and Grandpa's and Bristol's have far more plants to choose from than the catalog does, including most of the unusual and newer selections. They just have an amazing palette of colors and types of plants available at local nurseries these days. So, get some ideas. Think about what you might want to replace in your garden this year, what you've kind of gotten fed up with. Maybe it expands too much. Maybe it blooms for too short a period. Maybe, whatever reason, you're ready to do something different. Now's a good time of the year to have some fun thinking about what you could replace that with or expand in a new area for a garden. A little less lawn to mow is a good thing. Lawns are boring. They need to be mowed once a week for weeks and weeks and weeks, the entire season. So a little less lawn, maybe a lot less lawn in 2021 might be a good goal. And you can use mulch. You can use newspaper to kill the grass, mulch on top of it, and ground covers. There's many, many options. And if you have a specific spot you're wondering about, send me a note. I'll try and give you some ideas. Send me a couple photos. Michael@saverlife.com. And the other thing I wanted to mention, I was looking up ginkgo trees for some reason, and ran into a couple of posts. I didn't realize ginkgos were this old, but there's some ginkgo trees in China that are 3,500 to 4,000 years old. And this is not... they're not talking about how far back the ginkgo goes, which is actually like 100 million years or something like that. But it goes back a lot. These are some very, very old trees. And there are some cool YouTube videos of some of these trees. The ginkgo has a beautiful yellow leaf, and they tend to drop them all at once. And... so these ginkgo trees with these carpets of yellow on the ground that are pretty spectacular. And ginkgo come in male and female, so if you wanted one in your yard, just think about that. You plant a ginkgo now, it might be alive 4,000 years from now. That's really hard to conceive of. What was the world like 4,000 years ago when that ginkgo in China started growing? What was it like 2000 BC? The Iron Age, or just kind of hard to wrap your head around. But one of the reasons I was looking it up, I saw some horsetail in Linear Park, which runs... it's a beautiful park I hadn't explored. A couple access points, but one off of 441. Just as you go up the hill into where Five Mile Line Road is. And Linear Park, I found there was some horsetail growing. And couldn't remember how far back horsetail went. I knew it was something from the age of the dinosaurs. And I think it's like they figure about 270 million years ago that it was first seen, which is, it's also kind of hard to contemplate. I think the ginkgo is somewhere in the 100 million year range. So the horsetail, I say it was 270 million years ago. And then I ran into club mosses, which are actually not a moss, but they look kind of like a moss. I've seen them in the woods. They are very short. I've even tried to put them in little, terrariums, and not very successfully, but they are maybe 4 inches high, and they're basically evergreens, I think. And they actually go back something like 410 million years ago. even more mind-boggling. So they are truly living fossils, and things that you know, if you have a wooded area of your yard, you might have them. They're more likely to be found, on maybe on hikes, in some of the parks, and in the Adirondacks. I guess I've seen them more in the Adirondacks and Vermont, New Hampshire. But, probably some around here too. I can't remember where I last saw them, but I'm going to look at them more closely, in the future. So, just incredible to think about how far back those things go. And I've been having fun this winter as a diversion, just reading posts about some of the archaeology and some of the fossils and things that have been found in dinosaurs, and there's just a lot of cool research going on with these things compared to when I learned about them back in high school. So, and some of these are living fossils that are still with us. You can email me anytime with comments, questions, michael@saverlife.com. I'll be back with the food show, Discover the Finger Lakes today, and the grapevine tomorrow morning here, saverlife.com. Have a great day.